Postmodernism, What Does It Have Wrong? Was presented by Jack Crabtree on August 14, 2003 at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Postmodernism, Reason, and the Church. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
I got some feedback that my lecture yesterday was completely didn't make any sense. The question was, what did you say? So, let me try to summarize that as quickly as I can, because it really was a very simple point, and I apparently obscured it. But all I'm saying is this. Human reason has two aspects to it. What we could call maybe foundational intelligence, it's what I called the ROM, and the worldview out of which we do all of our reasoning. And the reason that we would include that as within reason itself, we wouldn't have to, but the reason it makes sense to say that's a part of reason is because it really is like the lenses through which we are looking at all of our experience and gathering our data. And so it really is the reason that we are using to interpret our world. Now, what I was arguing yesterday is that if we limit our thoughts to this part of human reason, namely the worldview, if we limit ourselves to talking about this, postmodernism is right in its claim that this is a construct. This is not mechanically and automatically and logically just delivered to us by our experience. We have to construct it. And what I mean by we have to construct it is we make choices, we make personal decisions, we make personal judgments. Am I going to believe that? Am I not going to believe that? Am I going to interpret it this way or am I going to interpret this other way? Am I going to accept this perception of reality or reject that perception of reality? Am I going to look at this evidence or am I going to ignore this evidence? All those decisions are at play as we construct my worldview, my basically overall philosophy of the world. And then that in turn becomes the paradigm through which I turn around and interpret everything else that I interpret. And we just keep doing that. We just keep stuffing stuff into the worldview we start from until it becomes unworkable. Until sooner or later, my worldview cannot accommodate my experience. There's too many things that I can't explain, too many things that don't make any sense out of my experience in the light of this worldview, and then we're in the market for a new worldview. And that's a conversion experience. And there are other conversion experiences besides converting to the truth of Christianity. People convert all the time, so they jump paradigms all the time. Well, that's what postmodernism is suggesting, and they're right about that, they're not wrong about that. That was my main point yesterday. Now, my qualification on that is, I don't know what the postmodernists think that they're saying. I think that they're, in their extreme moments, many of them would actually include this as part of what is merely a construct. 2 + 2 = 4 is not somehow absolutely true. It's an arbitrary, ultimately arbitrary construct. I think they would go that far. I'm not sure, but I think some of them would. And I don't believe that. That doesn't make any sense to me. I reject that. But if we limit ourselves to this, then I think they're right. Okay, so that was my point yesterday. What I want to get at today is to explore a little bit, what does it have wrong? And we can divide that into two things. What is postmodernism in its most distinctive sense? What does it have wrong? And then we've also looked at articles that look at what they call postmodernism, intersubjectivity, an emphasis on relationship, post-individualism, post-dualism, post rationalism, all that stuff that we saw in those articles suggesting those are postmodernist themes. I want to look at some of those things as well. But I don't think those things are at the heart of what makes postmodernism distinctively postmodernism. So I need to deal with those things separately. So let's talk first about people like Derrida, Foucault, the mainstream postmodernist thinkers. What do they have wrong? When they say that the worldview is a construct of a personal construct, or actually they don't think it's a personal construct, they think it's a social political construct. The community constructs the worldview, not the individual. That's another difference. And I think they're wrong about that. I think it's ultimately an individual, even though the community is a big influence on us. But there's a more fundamental error, and it comes with their view of truth. And this is key, I think, to understanding postmodernism. Postmodernism has rejected the traditional, the standard, the commonsensical definition of truth. Philosophers have a name for it. They call it the correspondence theory of truth. The correspondence theory of truth is when I make some claim X exists, I ask myself the question, is that a true claim, a true proposition, a true statement, or is that a false statement? To say that it's true, according to the correspondence theory of truth, is to say what you said is so. What you said is the way reality is. In other words, there's a correspondence between the claim that you're making about reality and the way reality actually is. If there's a correspondence between the two, then the statement you've made is true. If there is no correspondence between the two, then the statement you made is false. So if I said, there's a stool at my right hand, and sure enough, there is, in fact, in reality, a stool at my right hand, then the statement was true. If I say there's a stool at my right hand, and in fact, there is no stool at my right hand, then the statement that I made is false. Very commonsensical, right? That is indeed, I think, what we mean by true. But believe it or not, that's been rejected. And what underlies postmodernist thought is a rejection of the correspondence theory of truth. And what they've replaced it with seems to be a version of what philosophers call the coherence theory of truth. Okay, what do they mean by that? Let me draw a picture of that. All philosophers of knowledge agree. They describe what they call our noetic structure. And I won't get into all the details of the noetic structure, but I think it's enough for our purposes to know that we have a system of interrelated beliefs. So I have B1, B2, B3, B4, B5. B2 is derived from B1, maybe. B3 is derived from B2. B3 is used to help support my belief in B1. From B3, I can deduce B4, and so on. So there's these interlocking sets of beliefs that are mutually evidence for one another and support for one another, argument for one another, the basis of argument for one another, and so on. That's a noetic structure. Someone like Thomas Reed argues for a theory of knowledge that's called foundationalism. And in foundationalism, you have what are called basic beliefs. And basic beliefs are beliefs that are just somehow directly and immediately known to be true. Yeah, I don't have any other beliefs from which I prove them or derive them. Those are the basic foundations of all of my knowledge. I just have to be able to immediately and directly know that they're true. and that was the principles of common sense are among the basic beliefs for Thomas Reed. Then, from my basic beliefs, I begin to derive higher order beliefs up above them. I'll stop numbering them, but and I'm going to build up layers of beliefs in some sort of pyramid of belief here. From I get these beliefs from the foundational beliefs, and from those I derive other higher order beliefs and higher order beliefs, and so I go up the scale of the architecture of my knowledge by getting layer after layer after layer of beliefs. That's called foundationalism. And foundationalism typically will believe in a correspondence theory of truth, because what's underneath these beliefs, and indeed all of my beliefs, are rooted in reality. These beliefs are about reality and are ultimately grounded in reality in the sense that they are justified by their connecting to that reality, and that reality is the objective world external to me. Okay? This is getting a little technical, so at any point, stop me if you have a question. The coherence theory of truth, what's its relationship to reality? Absolutely non-existent. When I say that a belief is true, when I say that the stool is at my right hand, to call that true, is that because there actually is in the world a stool at my right hand? No, that's not what I mean by that. What I mean by that is, given all the other beliefs I have, maybe things like I can trust my sense perceptions, I am seeing a stool right now, it is, after all, at my right hand. I mean, things like that. Those are other beliefs that I hold. And to say that it's true that there's a stool at my right hand is to say all of my beliefs are mutually consistent with one another. They're rationally consistent with one another. There are no contradictions in my noetic structure. I don't have two beliefs that I'm holding at the same time that are contradictory or mutually exclusive of one another. And as long as I have that, then I have a sound noetic structure in which my beliefs are all true. But what if for some reason or another I am inclined to believe some other belief over here that's not consistent with all of these other beliefs? Well, one option is to call it false, because it can't be made rationally consistent with my other beliefs, and so I call it false. And according to the coherence theory of truth, that's what we mean by false, and that's all we mean by false. I'm not making a claim about whether or not it reflects anything in reality. Who knows? Nobody could know that, but I know that this is a belief that cannot be consistently held in light of everything I previously have believed. But there's another option. I don't have to call this false. I can decide, well, I like B6. That's a cool belief. I don't want to reject that. I don't want to call that false. Is there some way that I can make my noetic structure coherent and have B6 a part of it? Yeah. I mean, logically, that's always going to be possible. If I reject B1, that solves all kinds of problems. I can restructure my noetic structure and my line of argument and evidence such that I have an entirely different set of beliefs, all of which are mutually compatible logically and rationally. And I've just called one of the beliefs that I previously held, I've now determined that it's false. That is to say, it's a belief that's outside the coherence of my belief system, and therefore is not rationally consistent with them. So that's why I say that given this theory of truth, there's a guy named Quine, a logician at Harvard, who argued that even the laws of logic, something like A does not equal not A, is ultimately simply a part of our belief system that fits into coherent noetic structure. The reason we call it certain is because typically a coherentist will say, of all of our beliefs, they have different degrees of what they call ingression. That is, some of our beliefs go deeper into our noetic structure than others. And the deeper a belief is in my noetic structure, the less inclined I will be, the less willing I will be to ever come along and reject it. So the only reason I could decide to reject B1 and accept B6 is because this was not very deeply embedded in my noetic structure. It didn't ingress very deeply. B3, on the other hand, that was the law of non-contradiction, and there's no way in the world I'm ever going to reject that. I just like that too much to ever give up on that. And that's what we mean by certain. We don't mean that it reflects reality the way that it actually is. We don't mean that it's actually true in the sense that the correspondence theory of truth says true. What we mean is, I really, really like that belief and I ain't never giving it up. So in postmodernism, in principle, there's no reason why any of our beliefs have to be believed. Any of them are in theory fair game for rejecting and giving up and calling them false. So the net result is we have knowledge floating up here above the world that we live in, above the reality we live in. It's just floating there in midair, and they're not even pretending like there's any connection between the two. And if you come along and say, but is it true? I mean, naively, you're a freshman in college and you come, well, but is it true? Is it actually connected to the world? Does it actually say anything about the world the way it really is? You get a pat on the head and a coy smile and, oh, how innocent. How cute that you would ever think that our knowledge has anything to do with reality.
A little lamb.
You little lammy. Oh, you little lammy. So that's a given for postmodernists. They're not thinking the way you and I do in normal everyday life according to ordinary common sense. They don't even have the same concept of truth as we do. And so for them, all of our knowledge, literally all of it, is a construct, and all of our knowledge has nothing to do with the way things are. Okay, so if it doesn't have anything to do with the way things are, what does it have to do with? Well, that's what we've begun to explore. We saw it in Nietzsche, and we've begun to explore it with Derrida. It's a game of sorts that we're playing. We're using language to form beliefs, to embody beliefs as metaphors for beliefs that we hold. Why? Well, the name of the game in the end is just who's got the privileged position in society. And whether I like it or not, whether I can help it or not, just unconsciously, all of my speech, all of my text, all of my language is ultimately going to be about me seeking a privileged position, seeking to either gain or secure or defend a privileged position that I hold. And that's all language is. Now the thing, I think that's fundamentally wrong, it's fundamentally false, that's what I'm rejecting, that's what Christians have to reject, it seems to me, to argue that we could ever take this view of knowledge and reinterpret our faith in the light of it is just mind-boggling to me. I mean, if there's anything that's certain about the biblical faith, it's that it's rooted in the common sense that believes that our claims that God exists and Jesus is the Son of God and Jesus died for the forgiveness of our sins and so on is describing reality the way that it actually is. I just think that's inescapable. And it's just mind-boggling to me that an evangelical Christian would come along and think, well, let's look at postmodernism there. I mean, notice that those articles stayed away from this stuff. They took other stuff that seemed to be on the fringes of what you might be able to call postmodernism. They recognized that this is incompatible with our faith. But this is the heart of it. That is, the heart of postmodernism. This is the heart of postmodernism. You take this away, and you don't really have any postmodernism left. So, this is pretty fundamental. But look at Derrida for a second. Is there some truth to the notion that language can be used politically and in a power game? Well, absolutely. No question about that. But he makes a leap from there to the position that all language all the time is nothing but a power game. Well, that's a huge, huge leap. I find the first one very plausible, that there are times and occasions where we need to watch the way in which people are using language to try to shape the way I think and to manipulate me and control me. I think we see that in our society like crazy. And we can identify it, and we can see when it's happening. But does that mean that anytime anybody ever uses language, that's all that's going on? I don't find that plausible at all. Notice his concept of deference. One of the idea of deferring, and as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't pretend to be sure of my interpretation of him, but if as I understand it, you take a word like democracy. How do I know what democracy is? I look up in the dictionary and I find a definition that uses another six or seven words that are problematic to define it. Equality, rights, freedom, individuals, so on. And if I really want to understand what democracy is, I guess I better look up all those words in the dictionary as well to find out what it is then. I look those words up and I find six or seven other problematic terms that are used to define them until finally I get down to a place where I'm looking up a word that probably uses democracy in its definition. So I seem to have just this endless network of interlocking words, none of it ever grounded in reality. None of it ever touches down and says, this word means this thing in the world. All I have are words interconnected with each other, interlaced with one another. That's what he argues. Well, is that possible with a word like democracy? Yeah, I think so. I think in church and Christian circles, we do that all the time with theological concepts. A lot of our ideas, at least in individual personal cases, are ungrounded. I was telling my group, I was telling somebody, I remember as a high school student standing up in my student youth group in high school, Sunday school, to pray. And I was a mighty fine prayer. And I prayed these mighty fine prayers. And I talked about hope and grace and mercy and just really and, you know, you string a bunch of just reallys and hope and grace and sovereignty. I mean, you get this really, really fine prayer. But it occurred to me years later as I thought back on that, you know, I didn't have the foggiest idea what I was saying. Because when I came later to understand what these concepts actually meant in the New Testament, I realized that what I had learned in Sunday school was how to string grammatically correct, theologically correct sentences together. It was ungrounded in any real meaning. So does that happen? Yes, I think that happens. Derrida makes the leap to all language everywhere is nothing but a moment in interconnected language words, a texture of words all strung together. That's all any word is. Well, that's just false. That's just false because sometimes if I want to know the meaning of, if my child wants to know the meaning of the word apple, I go to the refrigerator and I say, here. I don't send them to the dictionary. I ground the word in the world, in the objective external reality that we're a part of. And lots of language is like that. Enough of our language is like that, that our language as a whole is grounded in reality. And there are these abstract general terms that get kind of slippery. That's true. It doesn't mean they can't be grounded in reality, however. It just means that they're slippery enough that sometimes we don't bother to ground them. And when we don't know what we're talking about. And if we're self-critical enough, we get to a point where we realize that we don't know what we're talking about. And so we try to figure it out. We try to ground them in the external world and what's out there. Okay. That's so One of the problems, one of the things that's wrong about postmodernism is the rejection of the correspondence theory of truth in favor of the coherence theory of truth, and their rejection of the notion that my knowledge has any connection whatsoever with the way things are. I just think that's flat out wrong, and it's totally incompatible with everything in the Christian faith. Second thing that I think is wrong with it is one of the ways that postmodernism describes, we mentioned this yesterday a little bit, the meta-narrative, that postmodernism says there is no meta-narrative by which to judge all and every other individual and particular narrative. Well, again, that couldn't be further from the claim that the Bible makes. The Bible is clearly and unmistakably offering us a meta-narrative whereby we can judge and determine and discern and be critical of all the other stories that we tell ourselves and that get told. This is one grand story. In fact, it's a very apt way to describe what the Bible is talking about, because I think, as I would understand the opening of the Gospel of John, in the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God. Indeed, God was the Logos. I think what he means by Logos there is what we might define as a script, the script of a story, a narrative. In the beginning was the narrative. The narrative was right there from the beginning with God himself. Indeed, God was the author of the narrative. I think he's using Logos in two different senses there. So I think what John means in John 1 is in direct contradiction to the claims of postmodernism. There is a narrative. There is one and only one narrative, and all other narratives are answerable to that narrative, and they're either false or true, dependent upon whether they're compatible with that narrative. That's the prologue to the gospel itself, is that we're all characters in this incredible unfolding drama of these creatures created by the creator God to interact with our Creator in this unfolding drama that reveals the character of God himself, his mercy, his justice, his righteousness, his holiness. It's ultimately all about God. You know, prima donna that he is, it's ultimately all about him. But this story is being told to be a self-expression of this being, this creator God. Well, that's the meta-narrative, I think, that the postmodernists reject. And we can't do that. The other place in this regard that I've sort of mentioned this before, so I'll just mention it again in passing, but the other place where I think, even when they have it right, that our worldview is a construct, even though they're right about that, they're Marxist enough to think that the basis for the construct is politics, is political forces, not individual, personal, existential forces inside of me. Whereas the biblical perspective, are there political forces? Sure. I mean, that is a reality, and you can identify that. But even more fundamental and even more basic than the political forces that shape our worldview are the existential forces that shape our worldview, namely sin. I mean, human sinfulness is the most important factor in dictating what we in our freedom do to construct the worldviews that we construct. We believe what we want because we want to believe it, because it helps us avoid thinking of the judgment that we're going to stand before God and have to stand under. That's probably the most important of all the forces at work. Okay, a couple of different directions I could go here. Let's talk then a little bit about, and I want to refer to the articles that we read, the other ways in which postmodernism is wrong, as that gets interpreted by these Christian writers who are somewhat more or less sympathetic with it at some level. Stanley Grins, let's take his article for a second. He describes that in this postmodern world, we need to recast, reformulate, rearticulate the gospel so that it is post-individualistic, post-rationalistic, post-dualistic, and post-noetic-centric. I don't know how deeply to get into this. Let's take the post-individualistic. I was telling my group when we discussed this, I have a real problem with that. Because in my mind, the biblical Christian faith is fundamentally and essentially individualistic. And I don't see how you can get around that. I'm going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ alone. Not with my parents, not with my church, not with my tradition, not with my culture. There ain't nobody around to help me. The question is going to be, what do you want, Jack? And what have you wanted in your life? You know, what has been the evidence of your life in terms of your relationship to God and truth? It's going to be the question. It's going to be about me as an individual, not what group I belong to or how my group did. Well, I don't think any of these writers are denying that. They claim that they're not denying that. But then they go on to say, you know, it's so much more than that. It's about relatedness. It's about intercept subjectivity and all that kind of stuff. What are they saying? What exactly are they saying? They're not really saying anything more than I can already read on the pages of the Bible. I didn't need postmodernism to guide me there. The Bible teaches me that I need to love my neighbor, that we need to love one another, and so on. We've been over this already. The Bible already teaches me this. Why is it that he's feeling compelled to credit postmodernism with this opening me up to relationship and intersubjectivity and communitarianism and so on? Why does he think that I need postmodernism to get me there? In fact, it's interesting in Grimm's is that he talks about how postmodernism leads us to this insight, and then he quotes the New Testament to prove it. Well, okay. Obviously, postmodernism hasn't advanced beyond the Bible if he thinks it's already there embedded in the teaching of the Bible. It seems to me that their method seems to be this. We look at our Christian culture and we determine what is amiss spiritually in the Christian culture. We blame it on modernism. I'm not sure they're even right there when they do that, but they blame what's wrong with Christian culture today on modernism. Then they propose that postmodernism has seen the error of modernism at that very point. So they propose that a gospel that has been postmodernized in the respect in question is going to be truer than this modernized version of the gospel that we have believed previously. But then, of course, he quotes a biblical passage to show that the problem predated modernism and the solution that the apostles give predates modernism. Why does that work? Okay, I don't see any point to that. I think the reason it works is because the whole concept of postmodernism, as you and I have experienced here together, talking with each other, is a very vague, imprecise, and slippery term. None of us really know exactly what we mean, what each of us means by it. So it's very possible to dump intersubjectivity and relationship and community and all this stuff into postmodernism, because who's going to prove them wrong? I mean, okay, if you tell me that's part of postmodernism, okay, then that's part of postmodernism. But it seems to me that they're doing the very thing that postmodernism doesn't like. They're manipulating us with their language. They're going back, picking up on themes that I'm sympathetic with, relationship, fellowship, love, intersubjectivity, all that kind of stuff, and calling that postmodernism, and then telling me, go the postmodernist route in your believing the gospel, in your acceptance of the faith, in the way you articulate the faith. Do it the postmodern way. I fear that what they want me to do then is to become skeptical toward the objective truth of theology. That's really what they want me to do. They never come out and explicitly say that. In fact, they explicitly deny that. But what other point is there in telling me to do it the postmodernist way except to try to unconsciously, unwittingly, subtly sneak into my thinking, oh, and by the way, being a postmodern Christian, I of course no longer believe in absolute truth, in objective truth, in fixed truth, in true truth. These are, after all, just narratives that we're telling, and so on. And so, at worst, I worry and I wonder whether this is not just a ploy to get me to soften my perspective on the truth of Christianity in the commonsensical meaning of truth. If not that, then the only other explanation I have is this is simply a symptom of our giving in to our lust for intellectual respectability. What's the hip and groovy thing to be in the world today? A postmodernist. Well, what if I could be a postmodernist and a Christian? Then I could be a hip and groovy Christian. And everybody knows that we'd prefer to be a hip and groovy Christian to a hated and despised Christian. So let's do it the postmodern way. And it may be innocent enough in terms of what they think the implications of that are and what that means, but it's still a huge mistake. Because even if I'm not going to buy this part of postmodernism, my terms are so slippery that by encouraging others to be postmodernist in their perspective and in their articulation of the faith, inevitably is going to carry connotations of, and don't believe in truth or nothing like that while you're at it. And that's ultimately nothing but destructive. So I think what they're leading toward, unwittingly or wittingly, is skepticism toward objective truth in theology and a free-form approach to the Bible. You know, one of the implications, it seems to me, clear implications of really truly being pre-postmodern would be I'll do entirely different things with the text of the Bible than if I'm approaching it with common sense. I'm going to deconstruct it, and I'm going to psychoanalyze it, and I'm going to play with it, and I'm going to recognize it as the game that it is, and I'm going to recognize that there's any number of valid interpretations of it, and no one is more valid than others. There's all kinds of stuff I'm going to do. And if you take that approach to the Bible, then we, as Christians, become utterly and completely, totally cut off from the only source, the only anchor that keeps us grounded in the truth. And that would be devastating. That would be hugely devastating. We're almost out of time, so let me just make one last point that, and this has nothing to do with anything I just said. I just think I want to insert this here. Carl and I were talking about this. Sorry, I'm going to repeat this, but Carl and I were talking about this. A couple of these articles that I read, they talk about absolute truth, and I think it's important to be clear about something. We as Christians have a habit, especially in ethics, of saying unlike the world around us, we believe in absolute truth. We make ourselves sitting targets for the postmodernists. I would say no, we don't. And let's get clear on what we mean. We Christians don't believe in absolute truth. We Christians believe in objective truth, but they're different. I mean, just think in terms of the knowledge in the sciences. The knowledge is in the sciences. We're not claiming that we have absolute truth of gravity or molecules or atoms or light waves or whatever. We don't have absolute truth. But what knowledge we do have is objective truth. And what we mean by that is the knowledge that I have is knowledge of the objective world the way that it actually is. It really is the way that my knowledge says that it is. I may be wrong about some aspects of it. I may need to change my mind. I may need to learn more. I may need to reformulate my theories. So what I have to tell you right now is not absolute, but it is objective. I'm not just making this up out of my own head. I'm making this up in relationship to something that's outside of me that really is just sort of there.
But there is an absolute truth. If it can be found.
Yeah, God knows absolute truth.
So that when we say we believe that there is an absolute, it doesn't mean that we have it yet.
Okay, right. But normally I think what people mean when they say we believe in absolute truth, they're usually thinking in terms of ethics. And so they're thinking something like, thou shalt not kill is absolute truth.
Oh, okay.
Well, no, it's not. It's objective truth. That is, what we really want to be saying, what we really mean to be saying is, when I claim that murder is wrong, when I make that claim, what I'm claiming is there really is a moral structure and a moral order of the universe that really is there and that we are answerable to. And so when I do murder, I'm not just making an arbitrary decision about how I want to make my life. I'm transgressing something about reality the way it actually is. I am in rebellion against reality the way it actually is. There is a moral order of the universe that I'm in rebellion against. That's what we actually mean by that. If it were absolute, then Abraham couldn't have been willing to kill his son Isaac. Right? If it were absolute. But it wasn't absolute because something else came into play that the commandment, thou shalt not kill, is not taking into account. It's not even pretending to take that into account. So we could reformulate the law and say, thou shalt not kill unless God clearly and unambiguously and unmistakably tells you to. And then we could say, well, now I have an absolute truth. And that could be true, except could there be another exception maybe somewhere, somehow? I mean, why would I claim that I know it absolutely until I know as God knows, until I know everything, until I know exhaustively and absolutely? Because to claim absolute truth is not a statement about reality, it's a statement about my claims about reality, and it lacks humility. You see what I'm saying? I'm claiming to know to a certain level and to a certain degree, and I'm really outreaching what I really can legitimately claim to know. I don't know if my principles have taken everything into account that needs to be taken into account. Maybe, maybe not. But I'm not really in a position to know. So unfortunately, when it comes to speaking in the context of postmodernism, we put ourselves in a position where we find ourselves in defense of something that we really shouldn't be defending. What we want to defend is the objectivity of moral truth, not the absoluteness of my knowledge of moral truth.
When you were just talking about absolute truth and objective truth, when you switched from the kill to murder, those things mean different things. But if you took a different example with that, isn't it an absolute truth that we should always love our neighbor or not commit adultery?
Yeah, I'm actually not claiming that there are no statements of moral principle that are absolute. There may be, but I won't really know that for sure until I can be sure that I've thought of all the possible contravening circumstances that might make my statement of the principle oversimplistic. See, that's the problem. Is the issue is when I state the principle the way that in order to ask, do I have absolute truth? Well, what are we talking about? Make a statement that you claim is absolutely true. We make the statement that we think is absolutely true. The question then is, will there ever possibly be any circumstances or situation where that formulation of the statement is an inadequate formulation of the statement? I don't mean to say, I mean, what? See, don't commit adultery seems absolute to me. But the reason I hesitate to just say flat out, that's absolute truth, no question about it, is how can I know that I have, is that, do not commit adultery, an adequate way of getting at what we are getting at when we say, I know what objective reality says about marital fidelity? It might be an adequate formulation of it. But if it isn't, it doesn't mean that I didn't know what marital fidelity was all about and that marital fidelity is good and the transgression of marital fidelity is bad. It doesn't mean I didn't know that. I was always in touch with that. But a circumstance may come along that teaches me, but if you want to be precise in your formulation of that moral principle, you didn't quite get it before. Well, am I in a position to know that my language is as precise, absolutely as precise, as it absolutely needs to be? Without more experience, how would I really know that?
And in a sense, in that way, if we're speaking in terms that you're saying that we ought maybe not to speak in, we could basically end up reducing absolute to something like moralism, or
right.
as we do in evangelical culture.
Yeah, well, what you see, is you see people making that mistake,
right.
is by falsely absolutizing things, they actually become immoral.
Right, right.
Help me with a good example, but...
I don't know.
I mean, anybody can...
Are you talking about things like smoking and drinking, or...
I was thinking where you actually become immoral by keeping your absolute moral principle. Okay. Right. Right. Exactly. Some of you may find this problematic, but I think it would be immoral to be hiding Jews in your attic and have the SS knock on your door and say, "Are you hiding any Jews in your attic?" And for me to respond, "I cannot tell a lie. In fact, let me help you find them," would be immoral. So I have absolutized a principle that basically is in touch with something that's morally true. We need to be people of truthfulness. We need to be people who are straightforward in the way we use language, and we never seek to deceive people, but don't make that absolute. Because a guy analyzed that situation for me once, it was really helpful, is what is the SS officer in it? Reframe what the SS officer is asking you. Is he not asking you, in fact, "Jack, will you help me in the abominable act of taking innocent Jews and killing them?" And to that, I'm going to say, "Absolutely not. I'm not going to help you in that act." And if I need to deceive you to not help you in that act, then so be it. You're the one that is culpable for my lie in this circumstance, because no one ever has a right to ask somebody to participate in what you're participating in. I should never be in that position to start with. So if I respond to that with deceit, yes, the world should not be a place where there is ever any deceit whatsoever. That's true. But you're the one who's put me in a position where, in order to do the good thing, I need to deceive you. That's a tragic situation, but you're the one culpable for that, not me. That was very helpful to me to look at it that way. But that's a good example, then, to take the principle, "Thou shalt not lie," as a formula, and absolutize that can actually lead people, by following that principle, into doing immoral things, I think.
Which is what God does with Abraham. He does ask Abraham to
right.
commit murder.
Right.
He, in that sense, blows away the universally held idea.
The absolute nation.
Yeah.
Yeah. When God asks him to offer up Isaac and kill him,
yeah.
then the principle, "Thou shalt not murder," is qualified there. Yeah, it's tweaked a little bit. Yeah.
I know you've run this by us, so don't be discouraged at the question. Would you please define subjective and objective? And what I'm thinking about a little bit is the article Honey, I, and Jane Goodall and David
Greybeard.
They're having this relationship of some sort, and at one point early in the relationship, it's subject Jane Goodall, object David Greybeard. Then there's a connection between them, and it changes subject to subject. And the author uses that as a paradigm of the change that we should make in our faith. That's part of what the confusion is, but I think a definition would be great.
Well, I don't know if you can give a definition for them that's going to fit all contexts, but
I'm talking about the takeaway definition, the one we want to go home with.
Okay. Okay. So is it subjective objective or subject object that you're asking me to define?
Guess you're going to have to do both.
Okay. Well, subject object, the way it usually gets used is subject just means the sort of creature who we might call a free moral agent, who's capable of acting like a subject, who purposes, intends, may communicate, think, so on. That's going to be a subject. And an object is something that lacks those qualities and therefore has, in a sense, a lower order of being in the world, such that they can be used, but they cannot really effectively use, typically. They don't typically have intent and purpose and so on and so forth. Now, there are actually degrees of that, but obviously.
Can subjects be objects?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, so a subject can be an object in the sense that if I, another subject, do not respect your subjectness and instead treat you the same way I would treat my coat or my chair, then I have objectified you and turned you into an object. And that's usually what they're getting at when they talk about the subject-object distinction in that way. That's a real problem I had with that article, because he went so far as to say God himself, you know, we should treat not only one another and not even gorillas, but all of creation in a subject-subject type relationship. And then he goes so far as to say, that's how God looks at the universe. And I go, yeah. God treats the universe as a fellow subject that he's sort of in dialogue with. It sounds to me like he's the sovereign lord over an object and he uses it however he damn well pleases. It looks to me like. So that he really is in a subject-object relationship, and it's only as it should be. What else can we be in relationship to God? We cannot be his peers. To be another subject, in the way that most philosophers like Kant would use subject carries with it the connotation of putting me under an obligation to respect it. You know, if you are a fellow subject, you demand my respect. That's sort of implicit in that language and that dichotomy that they use. So, and that's why he's using it that way, to make them fellow subjects. Well, the creation does not put any demands on the creator. God doesn't owe us anything. At least that's my perspective. That's my theology. And so it's not as, but it seems to be that's where he's groping toward, is to get to a place where God is such a sensitive 90s kind of guy that he's created this creation and he steps back and he respects it. Oh, you know, I feel your pain and I can identify with you and I can empathize with you and let me help you. And that it elevates the creation to a status of placing some demands on him. I don't think that's true. I just think that's false.
Your distinction about a claim to absolute truth versus objective truth is really helpful, and it's interesting to me that I don't know if it really is a change for you, Jack, but when I was first here 13 years ago, I heard that message different, and I think I was motivated to partly by my youth, but in my desire to have weapons, basically, with which to protect myself in the world. And in some ways, what the Study Center has been saying is trying to empower young people as they enter the jaws, the maw of the university environment, right, where we don't have tools to do that. What I gathered was that in having a conflict in having a discussion with someone who doesn't believe the biblical worldview or makes claims like postmodernism, that the first thing I'm going to do is pull out the law of non-contradiction, and the second thing I'm going to do is pull out the example of objective reality, that if you don't think objective reality is true, I'd like you to go stand in the street for a couple of minutes, and when the bus comes, say cheese.
Ignore it.
And that, in fact, what's interesting to me about that is I felt so empowered at the time by those things, because, of course, they're commonsensical.
Mm-hmm.
But I see now what cruel weapons they are, potentially, and that in terms of saying, I know absolute truth in doing so, how counterproductive they are to having an interaction.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think I don't know if it's intended that way or you intended that message that way, but I know that was one of the things I really grasped early, and it led me to want to feel confident using something like absolute truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you, again, have said it isn't that absolute truth doesn't exist, but I don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's a fine enough claim to say, but I am saying that there is objective truth, and there's a way to interact about that.
Right. Good. Thanks.
I said when I said that. Oh, sorry. Maybe not. Might have been my turn. I just wanted to tag when I asked that or interjected during your lecture about there is absolute truth. I think that was important to me because I believe some postmodernists may say that since there is no absolute truth, there's nothing that's holding about that. There's no responsibility. And so even though we are infallible in our fallible in our search for absolute truth in this lifetime, that the fact that it exists causes us to keep striving for it and looking for it, and that's our hope, and we're not aimless. That makes sense to keep gaining knowledge.
Though. Yeah, and I think that's what most Christians mean when they advocate absolute truth. That's really what they're getting at. It's just that it's a sitting duck for misinterpretation and attack, and it doesn't need to be. I think that's what I'm saying.
Is Moebel an exception to thou shalt not mortal, or does it depend on the issue more or less?
It is what an exception?
War.
Okay, good example.
That, of course, is... It's partly an issue of exegesis. It's partly an issue of how absolute the principle is, because you could certainly exegete it in a way where what he means by kill does not necessarily include war. But let's say, for the sake of argument, that it does mean thou shalt not take another person's life. Then it seems to me that by the testimony of the Bible itself, war is a qualification on that. That killing that happens in the course of war is not meant by the moral truth that lies behind that by that commandment. So that's a good example.
Can I ask a question first? Jack, in all this, would you mind giving us what your understanding is of the biblical relationship between our mind, which knows, our wills, which make choices, and our emotions, which feel?
Our minds, which know, our wills, which choose, and our emotions, which feel.
Yeah, and I
stole my question, too.
Or you could say great minds are thinking along the same track.
Yeah.
What I've been wrestling with is the importance of building a worldview from the data of experience, and the Bible's talking about that as an important characteristic of identifying me as an authentic Christian. And where my emotions come into that too. I mean, you've talked about how we need to make the choice. We need to be willing to believe that, to build that worldview and to believe it. But I'm just kind of wondering, where do my emotions come in terms of my being an authentic Christian?
Take this with a grain of salt, because I'm talking off the top of my head and probably don't know what I'm talking about. But my gut reaction is, the way I would understand emotions is sort of the way Thomas Reed understands natural language, that they're a kind of natural language that is that are linked to my beliefs. Now, there's pain. I mean, if I prick my finger with a pin, that pain is a feeling. That's not an emotion. I mean, that's a physiological phenomenon. But the emotion that I fear when I'm afraid, or when I doubt, or when I am grieved and when I mourn and stuff like that, it seems to me that those emotions are responses that God has built into us to beliefs that we have. So I believe a certain thing, and that's the sort of belief that creates this kind of emotional response in me. So it becomes a feedback mechanism where I can be alerted to the fact that I believe that thing. when I feel the feeling, I can know that I believe the belief. Unfortunately, interpreting those can sometimes get tricky, but at least it alerts me to something that there is a belief lurking back there that maybe I need to understand and examine and look at. That can be a true belief or that can be a false belief. I mean, either one is going to spawn the same emotion. So I think there's a rational component to emotions in that they are a sign response to a rational product, a belief. Now, when it comes to authentic faith, normally, under most circumstances, I'm going to have characteristic emotional responses to the truths that I believe when I believe the gospel. So the gospel can talk about joy and peace and stuff like that, and it makes sense because those are going to be a characteristic emotional response to that particular thing. But, I would argue, it's not that the emotions have to necessarily be there in order for the belief to be authentic. What's crucial is that the belief is there and that my commitment to the belief is there. The emotion will probably be there, but a lot can affect emotions. I mean, really, emotions are kind of like the surf or waves in the ocean, that you've got these cross currents all coming together, and there are times when I can feel a negative emotion at the same time that I'm focused on a belief that normally you would think would bring joy, but there are other things happening in my life, other things coming to play that's creating the emotional response. So I think it's treacherous to try to altogether demand of ourselves a certain emotional landscape in our life and judge our faith and the authenticity of our faith by that. I don't think that's right. The Bible never does, I don't think. It says, do you want to know if you believe? How do you act? How do you choose? What choices do you make? Not how do you feel? So that's my best.
Thanks.
Okay.
Someone asked a question a few days back about the implications of postmodernism and its effect on the church. Are you still planning on talking about that?
Well, I'd like us to brainstorm that. I will have a few things to say about that tomorrow. But
okay, so I should wait?
I'd like help. No, go ahead.
That's what I'm asking. What's the implications?
Is it Adam with one D or two?
It's two.
Okay.
No, it's just one.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you want to talk about that tomorrow?
Well, I mean, are you asking me?
Well, I mean, I don't want to, say this is your whole lecture tomorrow. I don't want to talk about it right now because then we don't have anything to talk about tomorrow. No, you don't get to answer your question, Brad.
How do you live with this guy?
I've been 2 weeks in Africa with him, too.
Do you have a question?
I do, but I want to know if we're going to talk about it tomorrow, then we won't have to talk about it today. Oh, wait, I'm patient like that.
Okay, Brent, we'll talk about it tomorrow.
I'll talk about it tomorrow.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. That's my question. Are you going to talk about it tomorrow? I thought it was a yesterday question. Thank you very much. I mean, here you go, Brent.
My question is more pertaining to today. At the beginning of your lecture, you were talking about student and the college professor, and you were talking, I think, about the noetic structure, and that the student asked, I didn't get the part, the student asked the professor a question, I didn't get the question. My question would be, like, what was the student's question? And then my second question would be, is if you were the student and you knew everything you know now, what would be an intelligent way to answer the professor when he goes, oh, you cute little whatever?
Okay, good question. Well, it was because you have to be educated out of common sense. Children are not sophisticated enough to doubt their common sense. So you have to be educated out of it. So there are a lot of people who've lived sheltered lives who come as a freshman in college and who they think that everyone thinks according to common sense and accepts common sense. So you hear a professor talking about a coherence theory of truth, and they're still trying to understand, well, what's the relationship between our beliefs and reality? Are our beliefs telling us anything about reality? Are they picturing reality? Are they informing us about reality? Is there any sort of relationship, any sort of connection between my so-called knowledge and the world the way it is? And that's what I was saying, a sophisticated coherence theory philosophy professor will just kind of condescendingly pat them on the head, oh, isn't that cute that you even care about such a thing? But should they care about such a thing? Well, absolutely. I mean, it's only commonsensical. My answer to that, I wouldn't have a good answer to that. The only answer I would know how to give is the one that Reed gives in his book. How's he put it? When you find someone who doesn't know whether he exists, you don't give him an argument. You take him to the nearest asylum or whatever it is. I can't remember how he put it, but you don't treat him like someone who just needs to be persuaded by argument, because the sort of thing, I exist, it's not the sort of thing that can be proven by argument. It's already more certain than I exist than any argument could possibly be that I could give him. And if for some reason that thing that is so certain that it's even more certain than any argument is, he says, not certain to him, there's something wrong with him. There's something broken about his common sense. And no argument's going to fix that. There's nothing you can say to him. You just need to patch him up somehow. Well, it's not that... I mean, he's being cute there, because obviously the guy is not sick, who's the philosophy professor. He's being willful in his rejection of his own common sense. What I would actually say to that person is, I don't believe you. I don't think you're sincere. And then if he persists, I'd say, will you allow me to videotape 24 hours of your day and let me look for the evidence that you don't believe in common sense, or that you don't believe that your beliefs inform you about the world? And I think I'd have mountains of evidence that every step he takes, every move he makes... I need a tune for that. is evidence that he actually believes he knows about reality. He knows about the world the way it really is. So other than accuse him of insincerity, I don't know what else you can do.
Don't you think as parents that we, if we understand all this, and I'm trying to understand it all, that we should, that should be our job, that we should help our kids in being able to dialogue with these people?
Yeah, it would, especially today, it would be helpful if the kids at a younger age got exposed to what we know about what's out there in the academic circles, especially, and be able to interact with them ahead of time, because otherwise it's a whole new world and it'll just bowl them over. They won't be prepared for it. That it would be helpful on the one hand. On the other hand, I was unprepared for it when I hit it, but there was, my common sense was intact, and I just, my jaw would drop. I'd say, you say what? You believe what? I mean, it just obviously wrong, false. I couldn't prove why it was false, and I at that point didn't know that I didn't have to prove that it was false. It ought to be self-evident to everybody, so I didn't have to prove it. So I was bowled over by it emotionally. It was a traumatic experience for me to try to, I felt like I was being rolled over and over and over by a breaker and didn't know which way was up at times. But I knew that they weren't right.
But then didn't you have to write what they wanted to hear, basically, to get a good grade?
I didn't. But I went to school in the 60s, and this is a whole nother game. My son did. And I wasn't in his shoes, but it was really funny. It was funny to read his papers. He was in international relations, and you can imagine there's a whole lot of BS in international relations. I'd sit at him at the dinner table, and he would be this person who believed this, and thought, and was telling me how stupid some of this stuff was. I'd read his paper, and he would just parrot all that stuff right back at him. And I don't know. He got good at it. He told them what they wanted to hear. And it may very well be, I can't judge him, because it's a much more of a pressure cooker environment today, I think, than it ever was when I was in school, and it was bad enough when I was in school. It may be that that's what you have to do to survive. I don't know.
There's been some classes where I couldn't get by, but there is a BS factor, and fortunately I can swing it to my favor in that I would say everything I've read, I'm constructing my worldview. And then when I respond to prompts on papers, I've had a lot of classes have had a lot of freedom in terms of the prompts, but even so, when I respond to prompts, I am, if I'm writing on Shakespeare, I'm writing about what I think Shakespeare is incorporating his existential views. And if I'm writing on, like, my last essay was on Conrad, I think there's a lot of existentialism going on, a lot of Christian parallels. And so fortunately, I think literature is really grounded in biblicism and stuff. I mean, whether or not they're correct.
Right. It'll depend a lot on the department. In philosophers tend to not be postmodernists. Philosophers tend to look at that and go, what? So it's a much freer environment for... I was very overtly a Christian in graduate school, and I didn't have any problems at all. But I chalked that up to being in the philosophy department. My son was in international relations, and that's all about political correctness. So it really depends on what department you're in. And if you can steer toward expositional kinds of things, yeah, as long as you're expositing what somebody else said, I don't have to claim that I'm believing this, I'm just telling you what this guy said, you're okay there too. So you just find strategies for keeping yourself out of trouble in a relatively hostile environment.
The only barrier I ran into was I was studying Jane Austen, and I wanted to know, because Jane Austen sets up these idealized situations, or I don't know if I'm describing it correctly, but everything works itself out. Everything, all these social constructs are, it's all about, problems being posited, and then everything works itself out one way or another, and everyone gets married, and everyone's happy. And I really wanted to know, I was like, where is Jane Austen in these novels? And my TA, who was a younger graduate student, would not, he kept staring, every time I was trying to directly hit it, where's Jane Austen? Brand, man. Going off in the other direction, like, and then every time we got onto Jane Austen, he wouldn't address it. And then I went to my professor, who was older, and I think he was more willing to discuss that Jane Austen had never been married and was kind of an ostracized figure in her community, and wasn't in the characters in the sense that, so there was a biting sarcasm behind it. But it was interesting because as soon as when I brought it to the TA, it's like, no, it's not an issue. It's a non-issue.
Because there is no author.
Okay, now are you saying the foundational beliefs are not absolute truths either?
Well, some of those I think are probably worthy of that. So the law of non-contradiction, I think anything that is logically impossible to be wrong, I think we have to say that's absolute. So I think that's an absolute truth. And maybe even things that are foundational common sense beliefs could be legitimately called absolute. So yeah, they are exceptional. I think we can say they're absolute truth. But anything that requires me to learn from experience, that's what I'm saying. It's objective truth that we have learned. Is it absolute? Well, we'll have to wait and see. That is my formulation of that objective truth. Is that formulation absolute or not? Well, maybe, but I have to wait and see, I think.
Yeah, Jack, how do they, in the noetic structure of the coherence theory, how do they account for, like, B2 being so fundamental to every human being? That I can't get rid of that one.
Culture.
So they would say...
Yeah.
Culture. Even though they would include things like the law of non-contradiction in B2, they say culture. Mm-hmm. So every human culture. It's all learned.
In principle, we could have... had a completely different noetic structure. The problem is that if I didn't buy the law of non-contradiction, I'm going to be pretty much out of sync with you. And it's hard to build a society and a community being that out of sync. So it becomes deeply ingressed in me. Isn't that right?
Well, I was just going to say the other part is the evolutionary side.
Ah, right.
The evolutionary is successful.
Right.
So it works.
Yeah. Yeah.
You done?
Done.
Oh.
When you talked about the honey, I woke up in a new universe guy. So his emphasis on, you think that his wanting creator and creation to have a more subject-subject relationship, the emphasis on relation, where do you think that is in the Bible, and where do you think it isn't, and why do you think we want it so much? What is it steering us away from, God's sovereignty or us? Do you know what I'm getting at?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think he'd want to emphasize that, and where is it at a fault?
Well, it's relatively thinly veiled, isn't it? Doesn't he have sympathies with environmentalism? And so he wants Christians to become more environmentally conscious and more on board with the environmentalist movement. That seemed thinly veiled to me, that's where he really wanted to go with that. And yes, I think the cost of that to my theology is I end up with a God who's not as sovereign and not as transcendent, is not the God of the Bible. Because he becomes just another species of being that is relating in this nexus of relational relationships. God with the creation with God, and me with the creation, and me and the creation with me, and me with God, and it's this big happy family that God is a part of. Well, I don't think that's the biblical God. I think the biblical God is such that all the kings of the earth are like a speck of dust on the scale. Brushes it aside and ignores it. I mean, God is so big that we have no intrinsic value and intrinsic meaning to God. If he invests meaning in us, it's because in his freedom he does so, not because he has to. And I think any other view of God is a different God, is a different view of the God of the Bible.
Yeah,